Welcome to another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we remember David McGowan and his important work that helped readers assess photographic images using instinct and common sense. Through his dedicated research, David McGowan taught many to tune into this valuable skill. The first In Other News interview with David McGowan aired on WBAI in April 2014. We discussed the investigative work and techniques used to analyze high-definition images from the Boston Marathon bombing. The second two-hour interview aired later that year discussing his recently published book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. And also the sudden attention it received from a wide demographic. His other books include Programmed to Kill and Understanding the F-Word, American Fascism and the Politics of Illusion, and Derailing Democracy, the America the Media Don't Want You to See. Although his original website is down, which is a real loss, his family members have posted some of his work at centerforaninformedamerica.com. On his website, there's a page titled, A Very Personal Message from Dave. It's dated June 14th, 2015. Just 9 weeks ago, on April 14th, I presented a lengthy video deconstruction of the 2013 Boston Marathon incident through the Caravan to Midnight radio show. About a week later, April 20th of all days, the nearly four-hour video presentation was uploaded to YouTube. Not long after that, someone using the name Phoenix Archangel posted an interesting comment. Quote, John Wells, the host of the show, always signs off with some of the best advice ever. Speaking of advice, this David McGowan fella really ought to quit smoking. With all the elitist feathers he's ruffling, he's likely to come down with a spontaneous case of hitherto undiagnosed stage 4 inoperable pancreatic cancer. And Dave writes, if you haven't watched the video yet, by the way, you really need to. And have your friends and family members watch it as well. As for Mr. or Mrs. Archangel, he or she wasn't too far off, though I've been told that it's actually incurable small cell lung cancer that has already spread to my liver and bones. And no, that's unfortunately not a joke. It's my new reality as of just a few short weeks ago, when my entire world was turned upside down, and I suddenly found myself being admitted to the oncology ward at Glendale Adventist Medical Center. 4 days later, I was beginning my first round of chemotherapy infusions. The second round begins tomorrow, on Monday, June 15th. The message continues. In closing, thanks to all of you for your support and encouragement over the years. I hope to be able to continue to expose the crimes of the elite for many years to come. Stay tuned. And there's an update by, I guess, one of his daughters. After a courageous and painful six-month battle, Dave passed on November 22, 2015, at his home in Eagle Rock. He was indeed one of the most stubborn individuals we have ever known, and he fought with every last ounce of strength he had. And that continues on and points out that he was a heavy smoker and that his job in construction exposed him to asbestos and other cancer-causing agents. I want to add that one of the interviews we did was by a cell phone, unfortunately, and he was in his car. He was at a construction site. He was working, and he was in his car, and he took time out to do the interview. We go now to hear part of the interview with David McGowan from April 2014 that aired on WBAI and on Dark Matter Radio about the Boston Marathon bombing. David McGowan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Very happy to be here.
You've done some interesting investigative work into a number of events, including the Apollo moon landing, the assassination of JFK, and the September 11th, and much more. But we want to focus in this interview on the Boston Marathon bombing. And we know that the FBI has been using informants to entice innocent people into crime for quite a while. Examples are the Liberty 7 case, the Fort Dix case, and the Memorial Day weekend terror plot in upstate New York, just to name a few. For a number of people, it's not a big leap in understanding the federal government's involvement in maybe producing crisis actors amid a staged catastrophic event. Now, in your photo analysis of the Boston Marathon bombing, there are so many anomalies, and you notice people who should have been covered in blood and were not, and specifically the individual near the person with both legs that appeared to be severed below the knee. Can you tell us about that particular scene?
That's the Jeff Bowman guy who we are to believe had both of his legs traumatically amputated and who was rolled off in a wheelchair and widely photographed and videotaped. Of course, those images were shoved in our faces to a pretty incredible degree after the event. Yeah, I mean, everything about him, as far as the photographic record is concerned, just does not add up. There were a number of people who claimed to have tended to him and people in the photographs who could be seen around him. Yeah, there is a noticeable lack of blood on these people. You know, there was an incident in New York, I believe in December, where there was this weird freak accident where a taxi like jumped the curb and clipped off some woman, some tourist's foot. Actually, the car actually amputated her foot. And weirdly enough, one of the first guys on the scene was none other than Dr. Oz, famous TV doctor. I have a quote from him saying there was a very limited window that they had to save this woman's life, because when a leg or a portion of a leg is blown off like that, and he was quoted in the newspaper as saying, and I don't have it in front of me, but essentially what he said was, when that happens, that femoral artery is going to start spraying like a garden hose. And it's weird to believe that Jeff Bowman had both of his legs completely blown off, you know, like above the knee, or one just under the knee and one above the knee. Now, this woman just lost a foot, and we're being told that the blood would be spraying out like a garden hose, and you would have a very limited window to save her life, to stop that flow and save her life. And yet, this guy supposedly lost both of his legs, and the doctor who tended to him was this guy by the name of Dr. Painter, and who was interviewed quite a bit by the media afterwards. And you can see him in the pictures, you know, wandering among the alleged victims. And he had on like this bright yellow, dress shirt. And he did not even bother to roll up the sleeves, you know, of his shirt. And I think he had on like some khaki trousers or something. We're supposed to believe that this guy performed emergency triage on this guy who had just lost both of his legs blown off and, you know, would have therefore been just spewing blood everywhere. And you can see in the pictures he did, in fact, tend to him to some degree. Walked away from that scene without so much as a speck of blood on him. Just spotlessly clean sleeves on his shirt, you know, no blood on his hands, no blood anywhere. And that was true of every single one of the responders. Every person who, you know, claim to or can be seen in the images tending to these victims, they all walked away without a drop of blood on them. There was this another guy, Dr. Levine, who was like a doppelganger for Steven Spielberg. It's kind of uncanny in the images how closely he resembles Spielberg. But again, you know, this is a guy who tended to a number of victims, severely injured, you know, supposedly. Guy was wearing like a white jacket, you know, and same thing, walked away without a speck of blood on him. And every single one of the responders, I mean, I have pictures of all of these people, high definition pictures of this whole scene unfolding. And there's not a single responder who walked away from that scene with like so much as even a drop of blood on him. And yet we're told that something like 15 limbs were blown off that day. In this very small, isolated patch of pavement, there were supposedly 15 limbs that were lost that day. which means, you know, the equivalent of like having 15 garden hoses spraying blood all over this scene. And yet every single person who gave aid or comfort to these victims walked away with no blood on them, you know? And that's just, there's just no way that that could have actually happened. It's also quite noticeable that none of the medical responders, the trained medical responders, the doctors, nurses, emergency personnel, paramedics, whatever, none of them took any kind of normal precautions that you would think that they would have taken when dealing with that much blood and the threat of bloodborne pathogens. A lot of them aren't even wearing gloves. Some of them are, but a lot of them aren't. And none of them, not a single person, can be seen wearing like eye protection or any kind of face protection, face mask or anything like that. Even though medical supplies were readily available, they had a very large, fully stocked medical tent just yards from where the blast went off at the end of the marathon route. And there were just scores of ambulances lined up. So there was no shortage of supplies, and yet none of these people, trained professionals, took the most basic precautions, you know. And I mean, we live in an era where my family dentist won't even drill my teeth without like putting on a hazmat suit, practically, you know. Wow. He wears eye protection and face mask and everything because there are real, very real threats. And yet these people were operating in a theater where, you know, 15 garden hoses were spraying blood all over the place. And that's in addition to scores of other people who suffered other grave injuries that fell short of amputation, but, you know, very serious injuries. And all these people are wandering around the scene without taking any kind of precautions to protect themselves from contamination. And all of them walked away blood free. That's just impossible for that to happen if this was in fact a real event.
There you go.
And if these were in fact real victims.
Good point.
And that's just one factor out of many, you know, the anomalies that can be detected in these images. But that is one of the main ones. I mean, that's a huge smoking gun right there. You know, how do you explain the fact that all of these people walked away without any blood on them, and none of them took any kind of normal precautions that a medical professional would normally take before entering into that scene?
So a glaring detail that you would think would be taken care of if it were a staged event, trying to convince people that the situation was real. So that's a very odd anomaly to look at. However, it seems if it were a staged event and these individuals were crisis actors that were involved here, they're relying on people not paying attention and being in panic mode. The photographic evidence, again, tells a lot. Many, many stories here, and it's trained people like yourself to be able to examine this and bring it forward, and courageous people too, because not many people are willing to take the risk to do this. So I got another question for you regarding the particular area that you focused in on, and specifically the two women. You did an interesting expose on investigating the images of the women who initially appeared side by side in a pool of red liquid, one with their legs sort of bent up unnaturally. What can you tell us about these women who were photographed a bit later on stretchers?
Those were supposed to be Crystal Campbell and her friend, whose name was Karen Rand, I believe. The one image that showed that you were referring to, which shows the two of them in the foreground, their eyes closed, and was very widely circulated, and it was generally claimed that Crystal Campbell was actually deceased in the image, that she was that she had already passed, you know, because her eyes are closed. She looks very much like she could be, and her legs, as you said, are very unnatural angles. They look like one of them looks like it could possibly even be severed. As these pictures circulated, that was widely claimed, in fact, that the picture depicted her as deceased, and also that one of her legs was severed. And in fact, a lot of people were quite outraged at that picture that think that image should be circulated, because it was widely believed that it did show her dead. But that's not actually the case, because there was another picture taken right after where her eyes are open and she's looking up at the nurse that's tending to her, and in fact appears to be smiling, actually. And then there's later pictures of her on the stretcher with her legs having been magically restored and in a normal orientation, you know, and not showing significant injury. You know, there's blood and whatnot, but her legs are obviously intact and attached and not in the condition that they appear to be in that first picture. And that picture appears very much to have been posed. You look at the sequence of events, and one of the amazing thing about this incident that we have never ever had before, you know, including with Sandy Hook or any other high profile multi-victim incident that preceded it, is that we really have a complete pictorial record of this, almost like a second by second accounting of exactly what happened on that scene from moments after the detonation of the first explosive device until the final last of the victims had been taken away. We have like a complete photographic record of that. You know, all of the statements of the responders afterwards claim that she was, you know, the most seriously injured of the victims, that she was in traumatic arrest, that she was, you know, on the verge of death from you know, virtually the moment of explosion. And, you know, several people claim that, you know, they rushed to her aid first because she was obviously the most injured and that she was, you know, the first one tended to and gotten out of there and blah, 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 blah. All of which is just completely untrue. If you look at the photographic record, she was actually ignored for a considerable amount of time. The medical personnel were wandering around, just completely ignoring her, until this nurse happened over to her, which just happened to be at the same time that the photographer happened upon her. And that picture was just captured a very brief moment in time when this nurse and photographer just happened to converge on the scene there and sort of set up this scene and take the picture. And then the nurse immediately afterwards wandered off without showing any sign of concern, without notifying any of the doctors on the scene. You know, we're supposed to believe that she just tended to this woman who looks like she's dead, and whose legs look mangled and is obviously in need of immediate and urgent medical care. And yet after going and posing for that picture, that infamous picture, she just walked away like it was nothing. The photographer walked away, the nurse walked away, and neither one of them notified any, you know, hey, there's a girl over there that's like minutes away from death. You might want to go, you know. No, nothing. I mean, it's just, the official story just does not match up in any way, shape, or form with the photographic record at all. It's just remarkable, really, how blatantly obvious it is from the pictures that, you know, the Crystal Campbell story that we were sold, it just doesn't hold water.
And it's another example of medical personnel behaving very oddly. You have the not taking precautions for contamination of blood, for example, and then just walking away from somebody in immediate need.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Dr. Painter, if you watch him, and, you know, his movements can be tracked, like, you know, second by second, and wildly out of whack. His official statements on what he did do not conform in any way with the photographic record. The guy, he wanders on the scene slowly, kind of meanders over there, actually stops in for unknown reasons into the LensCrafters store before he even bothers to go over to the victims. Then he comes out, wanders over, walks right past Jeff Bowman, who's laying there on the ground with, you know, supposedly both legs blown off, walks right past an elderly man who's like, I don't know, in his 70s, 80s or something like that, who supposedly also lost a leg, walks right past Crystal Campbell, who was seconds away from death, supposedly, walks right past all of these people, lingers around, then disappears from the scene again, then comes back on the scene, and then eventually he starts, you know, like tending to people. But even then, the first people he tends to are not the ones that, you know, are the media darlings of this event. You know, Jeff Bowman and Krista Campbell, the guy who lost both legs and the girl who lost her life. He continues to still ignore them and tend to other people with much less significant injuries. I mean, everything about his actions belies the notion that this was a real multi-victim, you know, traumatic incident. I mean, he's just not behaving the way a trained first responder would act in any way, shape, or form. So there's that.
Yeah, these are really critical anomalies to pay attention to. That start to paint a picture here that are consistent with other events that have occurred in the past couple of years, including Sandy Hook, the Sandy Hook shooting at Newtown School. This individual, Jeff Bowman, who had his legs blown off, and one of the main focuses in the mainstream media. Now, what have you found out about this individual in investigating some images that appear to be the same individual with both legs missing prior to this event?
The Bowman thing is a weird one. He absolutely had to have been an amputee prior to this event because, first of all, I mean, there's no way he would have lived through it. You know, I mean, the amount of time that he laid there on the ground unattended, you know, bleeding out. And yet, through it all, he not only didn't kill him. I mean, he didn't even lose consciousness, or lose the color in his skin and lips and whatnot, which is just bizarre for him to lay there for that amount of time, bleeding out, and then to be rolled out in a wheelchair of all things, still with his wounds undressed and fully exposed. And, I mean, the guy is still fully alert. He doesn't even really appear to be in a significant amount of pain. He doesn't appear to be in shock. He's fully conscious. He still has, you know, color. It's just, there's just no way that could possibly happen. I mean, just, you know, amazingly, not a single person passed out, lost consciousness. And I mean, you have like 15 people who supposedly lost a limb and all kinds of other people who suffered seriously traumatic injuries, and not one of them lost consciousness. One of these people, as they were taken out, were fully conscious and alert and you know, camera ready, including Jeff Bowman. And I mean, for him to not even have lost consciousness is just, it's mind-boggling. I mean, both physically and psychologically. I mean, how do you look down and see that where your legs just were a second ago are now just these bony, bloody protrusions? It's just inexplicable to me and to you know, there are numerous other people who have studied these images, how that could possibly be a real human response to having had both of your legs blown off. And, there's a video that I posted, a couple of videos actually, that show training scenes where professionally trained crisis actors, many of whom are amputees, are hired and used in drills for training purposes to expose first responders to what is, you know, considered to be as close as possible to real-world conditions. So they use these what they call crisis actors, who are oftentimes amputees, who, you know, have lost a limb or one or more limbs, you know, somewhere at some point in their lives. Many of them are military veterans, you know, but they are now fully healed, but they are made up to look as if their wounds are new and fresh and very realistically done. And I've seen some of these training videos, and the responses of these actors who are trained by, you know, military professionals and medical professionals that have experienced real-world conditions and know how people actually respond to the, you know, traumatic loss of a limb, And you see these actors on these in these videos, and they are acting nothing like the people in Boston. I mean, these people are just writhing in pain. Some of them are in just so much pain and fear that it takes 2 to 3, you know, military personnel to hold them down and keep them steady enough that somebody else can then begin to administer first aid to them. They are behaving the way a person would actually behave in the real world if suddenly, out of the blue, both of their legs suddenly got blown off. And the people in Boston were not. You see these people, and they're just sitting around casually, kicking back, you know, just, I mean, they look like they're just out, you know, to watch a parade or something. They don't look like people that have just had a leg blown off and are waiting for medical attention.
David, I wanted to get your assessment, since you've been investigating this fairly deeply, your assessment on what you think is really going on here, what's behind this particular event, and if it indeed was a false flag, for what?
Well, I think one of the main purposes is to condition us to accept an ever more overt form of the police state. You know, a big section of Boston was essentially placed under martial law, and you know, the images that came out of there were just terrifying. Of, you know, these heavily armed troops rolling through the streets of Boston with armored personnel carriers and attack helicopters and fully automatic weapons and conducting no-knock searches of people's homes and, you know, basically ordering people to shelter in place and just, I mean, they put that city on lockdown, you know, to go after a couple of kids, supposedly, who between the two of them had like one handgun, you know, if the official story is to be believed. And that required, you know, putting the entire, you know, a huge portion of the city under martial law, under lockdown. I mean, it was just mind-boggling the degree of, you know, unrestrained police force that was turned loose there. And that's happened several times since then in events that appear to be equally staged. You know, it's happened twice right here in my own neck of the woods here in L.A., once with the Christopher Dorner incident, where the entire resort town of Big Bear and Arrowhead were placed under martial law, and it was pretty much the same thing. They rolled in the armored personnel carriers, the body-armored cops with the automatic weapons, the helicopters, you know, every piece of military equipment they could get their hands on, and ordered people to, you know, basically imprison people in their homes and did no-knock searches, the same thing. After the LAX shooting here, more recently, which again appeared to be a completely staged, fabricated event that led directly to a limited state of martial law. It's a conditioning exercise to get us so used to that eventually we'll think nothing of seeing an armored personnel carrier full of heavily armed troops, you know, rolling down our residential streets. Even if you believe the official stories, it's hard to see how these most recent police responses are in any way proportionate to the actual threat. You know, in the Christopher Dorner case, they were chasing one guy, and they put half the damn state under martial law, practically. You know, in Boston, they were chasing a couple of teenage kids, you know, and in the LAX, they already actually had the guy in custody almost immediately, and yet still, you know, placed a huge chunk of the city under martial law. You know, these are wildly out of proportion responses, even if we accept that the official stories are true, which they don't appear to be. Oh, and there was another one actually in Santa Monica College, another one that appeared to be a staged event that was also followed by massive police mobilization. So, I mean, that seems to be the program now, is they stage a provocation and then follow it up immediately with this massive, overwhelming, ridiculous police response. And we are supposed to accept that now as the new normal, as what is necessary to keep us safe and protect the great American way. And I think that is a huge part of it. And as to why they're using crisis actors to do this rather than real victims, because, you know, it's not like their government has any real moral qualms with actually killing and maiming people. I believe if these were real amputees, they would not be behaving in any way, shape, or form like the people who came out of Boston, who have become sort of these media darlings and who were photographed within days, sometimes hours, of being injured, you know, sitting up in their hospital beds, grinning from ear to ear, and, you know, hopping around on their new prosthetics within, like, days. And the whole healing process that these people went through was so wildly off from what is the norm, you know, both physically and psychologically. Normally, losing a limb it's been compared to losing a very close family member. It's like suddenly and unexpectedly losing a spouse or a child. You know, it's something that's an integral part of your life that's just been taken away unexpectedly and is never coming back. And normally there's a whole multi-stage grieving process that goes on with, you know, a great deal of depression and anger and bitterness and resentment and confusion and anxiety and just a whole massive emotions, and suicidal thoughts and suicide attempts are not at all uncommon following a traumatic amputation. And, you know, it's a healing process that can take years to go through for most people. But these people were, like, making public appearances, smiling and just as happy as can be in their, you know, in their new legless state within, like, just, like, days of the incident. And that is not normal. That is not the way that amputees would normally respond. And my best guess is that they're doing it that way because it allows them to control not just the situation, but the aftermath and how it's sold to the public and used to implement their agenda.
Right. They're banking on the fact that people aren't going to pay attention to details. And what is your assessment of that, the public being easily persuaded or deceived, but it's still a comment on the hypnotic state that people are in?
Yeah, it does seem to be pretty easy to fool most of the people most of the time. Yeah, I mean, they don't even have to cover their tracks, it doesn't seem like, nearly as well as they used to, or come up with as credible a cover story. You know, I mean, as soon as one of these incidents occurs, whether it's a school shooting or you know, the Boston Marathon bombing or the ridiculous attack that supposedly happened in Woolwich, England, just after the marathon, people start shooting holes in the official story. You know, I mean, they just don't hold up at all anymore. And, you know, I mean, every aspect of the Boston stories of the pursuit of the brothers and supposedly killing one and capturing the other in the boat and then the friend of theirs that was, you know, basically summarily executed by the FBI in his own apartment. Every aspect of the story generally falls apart pretty quickly these days once it's subjected to any kind of scrutiny, but it doesn't really seem to matter because 90% of the people buy it anyway, you know, and just consider those of us who are trying to raise awareness to just be a bunch of kooks. You can consider me a kook all you want. You can completely disregard all the commentary that I have to make, but I defy anyone to go through my website and look at all of the 200 plus images that I have posted from Boston and tell me that we were not sold a huge bill of goods there, because the photographic record does not in any way, shape, or form conform to what we were told happened, you know. And that's regardless of what me or anyone else has to say about it. Just look at the pictures yourself. If you do so with a halfway open mind and put your biases aside, you're going to be shocked.
That was part of an interview with David McGowan from April 2014 about the Boston Marathon bombing. And in the show, we're remembering David McGowan, who passed in November of 2015. Let's go now to an interview with David McGowan on his recent book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon Covert Ops and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. This book reveals very disturbing elements and connections within the birthplace of the so-called hippie movement in Laurel Canyon. The landscape itself is riddled with man-made and natural tunnel systems, some attached to mansions and military installations. However, the groundbreaking investigative work from McGowan are the counterculture rock star connections to military families and the United States military machine converging during the anti-war movement. Did all of these components, the anti-war movement, a rock and roll counterculture, military intelligence connections, and more, accidentally fall together? McGowan says, probably not. David McGowan, welcome back to In Other News for the second part of the interview.
Well, thank you for having me once again.
For listeners who may not have heard this last week, can you tell us briefly about how you came to write Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream?
I made the mistake of taking a book on vacation with me that I thought would provide some light, mindless vacation reading, and instead it just inspired this, what eventually became this book, what started out as a series of web posts and eventually grew largely by popular demand into first a book length series of web posts and now an actual book.
Can you summarize some of the content of the book in that description, please, David?
The book basically covers the dark side of what has generally been presented as this very idyllic sort of bucolic hippie utopia where life was just couldn't have been better, and where, you know, all of these rock stars were living in this very small geographic area that kind of set off from the rest of LA and is very, got a very country feel to it. It's very heavily wooded and very rustic and, you know, not at all like other parts of LA or what people picture LA being like. And it's generally been cast as this really just ideal utopian society where everyone kind of had an open door policy.
Yeah. In the first hour, we talked about the covert military aspect of it, and in a broad metaphor, a past guest on this show, listeners know, novelist and writer Professor Eric Larson. He's the author of Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit, and another book titled The Skull of Yorick, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Grave Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. Well, he wrote extensively about the cultural damage sustained from a media landscape saturated with lies and deceit. Cultural damage such as insipid, mindless music, bad artistic ideas, poor novels, bad writing. And it's interesting because here you have uncovered these covert military resources propping up a music scene. And then when you peel back some layers, as you did, you find that, yeah, this hippie culture didn't spring up from the grassroots as many would like it to be remembered. Professor Larson goes on to describe it this way, and he's relating it to the lies about 9/11. There are similar lies here. He writes, "And so we come toward our end by returning to the great question that caused all of this searching. Can there be a literary life in a post-1984 nation? Can there be a literary life in a nation of the kind the United States has become over the past few decades, and especially since 9/11? The answer is very clear. No, there can't and won't be a literary life in such a time and place, nor will there be the production of a literature of depth, complexity, authenticity, significance, or durability. Why not? Because the creation of a true, real, or significant literature is impossible when a people lives or is forced to live in ignorance of the whole truth of their own lives, of their nation's lives, and the lives of those they live among. For so long as Americans continue to be deprived of or continue to be conditioned into an inability to see and know at least half the truth of what their own lives are, and at least half the truth of what their own nation is and is doing, they will remain at the very best half people living half lives in half blindness and thinking in half thought. You compare the music of back then to now, and there's certainly a big difference in the quality.
Oh, huge difference. To my mind, the scene was definitely controlled in those days. But even given that, the music lives on, and the music had a power all of its own. And, you know, to this day, you can hear these songs played on a regular basis, and they still sound good, and they still sound fresh and current in a lot of cases. And it's very, very hard. And some of the, you know, this stuff dates back to as much as 50 years. You know, the very first release was by the Byrds, Mr. Tambourine Man, in 1964, that really sparked this, the whole folk rock revolution, and eventually led to psychedelic rock and country rock and various other factions. You know, their first release in 1964 that really got the ball rolling. And you can still hear that song on the radio today, and it still sounds good. And, you know, I find it very hard to believe that 50 years from now, anyone's going to be listening to or care about, you know, Justin Bieber or Ariana Grande or Rihanna or Lady Gaga or whoever the flavor of the month is right now. You know, these artists, they have a real flash in the pan quality to them, you know, where they just sort of emerge out of nowhere as these fully formed artists with the sound and a look and a stage persona and all of this, and just seem to come out of nowhere and garner like 20 million Twitter followers and 100 million YouTube hits. The level of attention and wealth and fame that they achieve in a very short time is just so wildly out of proportion to their actual level of talent. It's like the arts have been so degraded now that the 1960s, even to the extent that it was controlled, it seems almost innocent. Today, you know, talent seems to be secondary at best, and really, if you've got a marketable face and an image, you know, they can auto-tune you and make you a star nowadays. Yeah, there's been a serious degradation of the arts, to my mind. It's very hard for me to believe that anything that's out there on the musical landscape now will have any relevance even 20 years from now, let alone 50 years from now. And I don't see any of the quote-unquote art that's being created now, and not just in the realm of music, having the kind of staying power that that what was created in the 60s had.
Yes, so the manipulation was going on back in the 60s, but not at the level we're able to see now.
Yeah, see, those are kind of innocent days. Those are kind of, seem almost kind of like the test days of the star making apparatus, and now it's been refined to such an extent that they can seemingly just make anyone they want to a star virtually overnight now, and irrespective of talent or anything else. We're not moving in the right direction, that's for sure. You know, it's these processes, they've had 50 years to work on the star making process, and they seem to have become quite adept at it, and it's really sad what passes for art in this culture nowadays.
Oh, I find it interesting that Professor Larson had connected it back to a culture being saturated in lies to begin with, and not knowing the true nature of the country's direction, and being lied to, not having the truth or some aspect of the truth, then influences art.
I mean, it's hard to even know what is art these days. You know, there's been such a blurring of the line, a deliberate blurring of the lines between art and, or between news and entertainment, in incidents like Sandy Hook and in Boston and whatnot, between what is real and what is not. You know, I mean, it's hard to know when you're watching, you know, TV or movies or whatever, if what you're watching is even real or not anymore, whether you're watching it on an entertainment channel or a news channel. You know, it's very difficult to know, you know, when you're being lied to and what's real and what's not. And to a large extent, you know, I mean, everything we're told is a lie anymore.
Very good point, David. In your book, you talk about someone named Vito Paleckis. And could you tell us where he came from and how he's connected into the Laurel Canyon hippie scene?
Yeah, he was actually a very key figure, although it took me quite a while to realize that. Again, that was a case where there was very limited information available, and I would occasionally come across his name in various books. But, you know, it wasn't until I just kept coming across it more and more that I realized that, hey, this guy seems to be popping up in a lot of places and connected to a lot of people. He must be more important than I thought. So then I had to go back and dig up all these facts, and still had a very hard time piecing together a very complete profile of him until I got in touch with a family member, ultimately contacted me and confidentially supplied me with some additional information to where I was able to sketch out a fairly accurate profile of this guy. And the 50s and early 60s, he was known as a sculptor, and he had a studio where he had a very elite Hollywood clientele that included people like, I think, Mickey Rooney and Jonathan Winters, Steve Allen, I think, were clients of his. So he was a pretty well-connected guy. Then in the early to mid-60s, he sort of morphed into Vito, the leader of the freak troupe, and he amassed this troupe of people around him, mostly women, frequently very young women. And he formed this sort of freestyle dance troupe that would go out to the clubs and, you know, big groups of them, and perform just these wild and crazy dance routines on the dance floors of the clubs. Initially, and this was confirmed by a number of people on the scene, who, including some of the band members, who, you know, acknowledged, yeah, the people weren't initially coming to see us, they were coming to see the sideshow on the dance floor. Because when this scene first started, I mean, it really kind of came out of nowhere, and none of these bands were known yet. You know, they were just coming out and starting to get signed and getting record deals, and all of these clubs started opening up to accommodate all of these new musical stars. And you know, the clubs were all either brand new or recently reopened. And so the clubs didn't have an existing clientele, and the bands had no name recognition at all. So one of the things that really helped to launch these bands and really get the scene going was Vito and his freak troops heading out to the clubs and putting on these very well-publicized public spectacles. And the people that's what initially drew the people to the clubs, was not so much who was, they didn't care so much who was on the stage, it was the show was on the dance floor. They were very instrumental helping to form and launch the first band, the Birds. They provided them with their rehearsal space. By some accounts, they booked, Vito booked their first concert for them. And, you know, they showed up at all the clubs to, you know, draw the crowds into their shows. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, these people were so popular that the club owners would let them in free, welcome them with open arms, because where the freaks were is where the crowds went. So by letting them in, you were guaranteed to draw a crowd to your club. You know, it didn't matter who the band was on the stage. If you had the freaks, then you were going to get the audience. So they were absolutely a very key element of this scene. And also, you know, this one always gets me into trouble, is that people don't like want to hear this, but the reality is, and, you know, this is also documented, that a lot of these bands weren't necessarily all that talented when they first started out, which is why their albums were recorded by studio musicians, because they were not yet accomplished enough to perform their own songs. But, of course, you couldn't use studio musicians on stage. They had to play their songs live. So the Freaks also served another function, which was distracting attention away from the fact that the music coming from the stage did not necessarily sound the same as it did coming over the radio, you know? So, and they were such a key part of the scene that the Birds actually took them with them on their first nationwide tour as part of the part of the band and actually took them on the road with them and had them doing the same thing in clubs in like Iowa or Kansas or whatever, which was what first introduced parts of the country to what would soon become known as the hippie-looking culture, was the Byrds taking these prototype hippies on, and they are acknowledged by many people who are on the scene as the quote-unquote first hippies. Beto's wife actually opened the first clothing, she's credited with opening the first clothing shop and selling what became known as hippie fashion. So they were absolutely a very key part of this scene as far as introducing the look and promoting the bands and launching the bands and getting the audiences out to see these bands. Very, very key part of the scene, and who had been like complete, who was all but forgotten before I started digging into him in his book. And now he's got his own Wikipedia page, and I don't even have my own Wikipedia page, but Vito Palikas has his own Wikipedia page now. Sculptures prominently displayed on websites, and all of a sudden there's been a resurgence in interest in this guy who had been, you know, all but forgotten. He also just happened to be related by marriage to the Rockefeller family. Because, you know, when you think of the genesis of the hippie movement, you immediately think Rockefeller, right? That's, they go hand in hand, apparently. So, yeah, very interesting figure who was a very key figure in the background of this scene, and just happened to be related by marriage to the Rockefeller clan, of all people. Fascinating figure, to say the least, who, like I say, is now enjoying a resurgence in popularity now.
Because of your work.
You know, there's been some additional stuff dug up and thrown out there on the internet, you know, about that since the book came out, or since the book, you know, has been in the works. And now, you know, you can find reports out there claiming that the Lookout Mountain laboratories actually didn't just process nuke film tests. They actually faked nuke film tests is what some of the stories coming out now are claiming, which is very interesting because, you know, before I started digging into it, nobody seemed to really know or care about Lookout Mountain, and now there's, you know, this new information coming out, and, you know, Vito Palikas was all but forgotten, and now he's, you know, enjoying this resurgence, and Admiral Morrison is another one. You know, when I started digging into him, nobody knew or cared who the hell Jim Morrison's father was, beyond the fact that he was some high-ranking naval officer guy. But, you know, beyond that, nobody seemed to know or care much about him at all. And now there's stories out there on the internet claiming that he was sort of the hero of the USS Liberty incident with Israel in, what was it, 1969 or something like that? I'm far from being an expert on it, but it was an incident where Israeli forces like opened fire on a U.S. ship, USS Liberty. I think maybe sunk it. There were some casualties and whatnot, and it was kind of swept under the rug. According to reports that I've seen recently on the internet, Admiral Morrison was supposedly like the hero kind of that incident. So it's hard to talk about this stuff without like sounding self-important, you know, but I just find the timing very curious, you know, and the fact that I'm now getting criticized by some people for, like, not including this information in the book, you know. I've gotten emails from people saying, hey, you know, you talk about how Admiral Morrison was, you know, a key figure in the Talking Gulf thing, but you don't talk about how a few years later, he was the big hero of the USS Liberty incident. You know, why didn't you present a more balanced portrait? I'm like, because that information was not out there when I did my research, you know. It just seems to have suddenly appeared, you know. And the same thing with Lookout Mountain. I've gotten criticism from that. Why didn't you talk about how they faked the nuke test there? Well, again, that information was not out there when I was doing my research. The additional information on Vito that's not now out there was not available. Suddenly, you know, some of these topics, which had been very, very obscure topics that nobody was really talking about or cared about, have now suddenly become talking points in certain circles. And I find that a little curious, you know, that the timing just seems a little strange, you know. I mean, I don't know that it's all deliberate, but it certainly seems convenient that now I'm being criticized for not including information in my book that was not even available when I was researching the book. It's been kind of weird to see this stuff sort of pop up.
Getting back to Lookout Mountain Laboratories for a minute, I watched a short video on the geology of Laurel Canyon, and a lot of the rock is sedimentary from the seafloor, though, as the ocean receded, but left caves formed in different layers of the sandstone and as the water percolated down through the hillsides, including volcanic debris, compressed rock from deep in the earth, and the soil is from 12 million to 200 million years old. The point is, I guess, that the canyon is littered with tunnels and caverns that are man-made and natural. And it was said in an article, it was an added real estate bonus discovered when the elite began buying up homes all over the Hollywood Hills. So that might connect to Lookout Mountain as well. Even though it wasn't a fictional film called Wavelength, that miner said that he helped build Lookout Mountain and dig six stories down. It's interesting. So the geology of that area is kind of spooky as well. Can you talk about that?
There's been rumor and talk of secret underground tunnels in that area going back a very, very long time. Two of the initial structures, the iconic structures that were first built across the street from each other on like one of the main intersections there, on Laurel Canyon Boulevard and Lookout Mountain Avenue, is what became known as the Houdini House, which was built as sort of this Gothic castle with long rumored to just be absolutely laced with secret passageways, secret tunnels, and underground lairs, and all manner of weirdness. And then right across the street from that was a structure originally built as a hunting lodge, and at one time owned by Western actor Tom Mix, became known as the Log Cabin, which is where Frank Zappa and then later Eric Burdon took up residence and kind of ran it as a communal gathering spot.
That's going to do it for In Other News and Remembering David McGowan, who passed in November 2015. He leaves behind a very important body of work, including his four books, which you can find out more about at the centerforaninformedamerica.com.